This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support for Talk Louisiana comes from Brian Lowe Financial. And thanks so much for joining us today. Your numbers are 877-217-5757. That's if you're calling anywhere on the planet. We haven't given the Baton Rouge number in a while, 297-5633 if you're calling locally, but you can reach us with the other number as well. And you can always send an email to talk@talklouisiana.org. And we are slated, if things go according to plan, to hear from death penalty activist Helen Prejean, who has a long history in this state and beyond, has become world famous. She wrote Dead Man Walking, which became a popular film with Susan Sarandon in the lead role. It was directed by her then boyfriend, the longtime companion, Tim Robbins, and it was a great film. And Sister Helen, of course, has an amazing story to tell, and we hopefully will hear from her today. She postponed our appearance on Tuesday to be with us today, and hopefully Sister Helen is where we think she should be at this time. I first met this fine lady in 1987. She's been doing this for a long time, and that's 32 years ago. It was the night of June 15th, 1987, at Angola. Death row inmate Jimmy Wingo was scheduled for execution, and in those days, executions occurred right after midnight. It was state law, and there was an electric chair. The inmates were electrocuted. And there was this big buildup. You had to be at the prison by 8 o'clock at the latest, and then you had to wait 4 hours to be herded into the death chamber. And that was 1987. That summer, the governor was Edwin Washington Edwards. He was running for re-election, and no less than 8 inmates were executed, all electrocuted, shortly after midnight in the summer of 1987. We haven't had an execution in this state in more than a decade. And part of the reason, of course, is that the drugs that are used are not available. And electrocutions were stopped in Louisiana some time ago. But it was a gruesome ending of a life, as you can imagine. And some people believe that people who are on death row deserve what they get. After all, they are there because they killed somebody. In Jimmy Wingo's case, he was 35 years old, a career criminal, but nothing of a terribly violent nature. And he and another inmate, Jimmy Glass, were in the Webster Parish lockup. And on Christmas Eve of 1982, they broke out of jail, and they entered an uninhabited dwelling at the time owned by Ernest and Lurleen Newton. And the Newtons showed up, and Jimmy Glass took a shotgun and killed both of them. Now, Jimmy Glass was executed a few days before the execution of Jimmy Wingo, and Glass was a younger man, about a decade younger than Jimmy Wingo, and he was killed by the state, and then a week later, Jimmy Wingo got his choice, even though he did not fire the shots that killed the Newtons. He was an older man, and of course, there was the impression that he might have had some undue influence on Jimmy Glass, and as a result, the life of Jimmy Wingo was taken by the state of Louisiana. He gave a compelling final statement. In those days, of course, when they were electrocuting people, they shaved all the body hair from them. Wingo was a white man. And of course, when he was executed, his body turned a different shade, as you can imagine. His fire went through his body and killed him. And I was there as a witness. I remember Kevin McGill, who's now with the Associated Press, was one of the fellow witnesses, and they probably remember me, those who were there. The DA who got the execution for Jimmy Wingo and Jimmy Glass, Henry Brown, he was not there for Wingo. He had been at Angola the previous week when Jimmy Glass was executed. But in those days, I'm looking at Matt Doyle, our producer right now, and he's between me and a pane of glass. Well, I was closer to Jimmy Wingo when he was being executed than I am to Matt Doyle right now, our producer. And there was a pane of glass. And so I'm leaning back in my chair, taking notes as this man's being killed by the state of Louisiana. And I fall over and crack my head open. And the coroner, Dr. Alfred Gould from West Feliciana Parish, he comes rushing into the witness room to tend to me, as Jimmy Wingo is, of course, dead in the next room. He said, there's no hope for him, but we might be able to save you. He said, I haven't worked on a warm body in a while. And so he patched me up and got me to the infirmary at Angola, and they wrapped my head in a towel, told me to get some stitches the next day, and I was off to the post-execution press conference with a towel around my head. And in some ways, it was funny, but on the other hand, a man who'd just been killed by the state of Louisiana, so I tried not to become the story that this guy fell over, and actually, I was knocked out cold, too. I was out cold for, I don't know, a minute. And the witnesses were there trying not to make me the story either, and ultimately, of course, that one happened, and then there were 8 executions in the summer of 1987, and that's when I met Sister Helen Prejean, who is joining us. And good morning, Sister Helen. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Hey, Minster, how are you?
And I just told the story about Jimmy Wingo's execution, June 16th, 1987, and...
Oh, yeah. Eight and a half weeks? God, it was terrible.
8 people killed that summer. And a Democratic governor, Edwin Edwards, he was not
like a third rail at that time. This is the first national presidential. You know, there's music. Okay, good. That's helpful. There was music coming on strong. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Do we have... Okay. Okay, I can hear you, and hopefully you can hear me, Sister Helen.
Yeah, good, Jim. Good to hear your voice. Boy, you've been a steady voice out there. And
well, so have you. And
let's do it.
Let's do it. The book is River of Fire, and we're going to get to that. But, of course, there are many people who disagree with you, but it appears that public sentiment is moving in your direction. Why do you think that's the case?
Well, we've been at the death penalty since 76. Certainly Louisiana had its share. We had 8 executions in the summer of 87. I mean, we were killing people right and left. But now, 30 years later, 35 years later, we look at it. It's very, very costly. We also now know we have made a lot of mistakes. We thought it'd be a fluke that a wrongfully convicted person would go to death row. Actually, Louisiana has the largest number, percentage-wise, in the United States of wrongfully convicted people on death row, who by luck and the grace of God and good lawyers and evidence that hadn't been destroyed were able to show they'd been wrongly convicted. So the public's been, you know, impacted by that we may have made so many mistakes. And then you have a rising number of voices, like murder victims' families. We're beginning to see it's only very certain murder victims' families who get this so-called justice, almost never black families who have had someone killed get it. We also see how it's only poor people chosen for execution, and 80% of them, it's because they kill white people. We just see how discriminately applied it is, how capriciously it is. Of all these reasons, I think, and cost is no small thing. At first, I wasn't too happy about that. I thought, oh, no, we're going to put it down because of the money. And then I read that Martin Luther King said a budget is a moral document. So, like, take Louisiana, we're struggling for funds for everything. You're going to spend millions of dollars to execute a few people instead of putting it into community policing, working with at-risk kids, all the things that can prevent violence in your society. And we haven't had an execution in going on 18 years. What's happening? And that what's happening across the United States is, in practice, people are putting the death penalty down. The last step is going to be to repeal it on the books of legislators. And we are getting close to that in Louisiana.
The advocate called for a vote of the people. There was a measure that was in the legislature this past session that did not make it to the final round, but it would have allowed the people of Louisiana to vote on whether capital punishment should be present in our state. Do you think the vote would have been in the affirmative, or would we have voted to abolish capital punishment in Louisiana?
No, I would think it would be in the affirmative because it's what you call an unreflective answer. It's a knee-jerk kind of thing. People say, oh, look, people who do terrible crimes, let's reserve it for only the worst of the worst.
877-217-5757. We'll be back with Sister Helen Prejean on Talk Louisiana after this 90-second pause. Back in a moment. This is Jim Eakster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana. Matt Doyle producing. Your number 877-217-5757. Sister Helen Prejean is with us. Her memoir is River of Fire. 1993 was the year she wrote Dead Man Walking. 2 years later, it became a major film starring Susan Sarandon and Sean Penn, adapted as an opera, first produced by the San Francisco Opera in 2000. Her latest work is River of Fire, My Spiritual Journey, and we will talk with her about things other than the death penalty, but that is what she is best known for. And Sister Helen, before we go to our first caller, you have accompanied, I think, 6 inmates to the death chamber. How was that experience?
Well, it changed my life. In fact, in River of Fire, which is my spiritual journey that led to my awakening that the gospel of Jesus calls us to work for justice and not just be charitable. In the preface of it, the fire part of the chapter is, this was the killing of Patrick Saunier in 1984. They killed a man with fire one night. They strapped him in a wooden chair and pumped electricity through his body until he was dead. His killing was a legal act. No religious leaders protested the killing that year, but I was there. I saw it with my own eyes, and what I saw set my soul on fire, a fire that burns in me still. Now, here's an account of how I came to be in the killing chamber that night. And boy, now things have really changed this past year with the bill before the Louisiana legislature. Archbishop Greg Amon and I sent out a joint letter to all the Catholic schools encouraging young people, even though they can't vote yet, to get involved in the process with the legislature to end the death penalty in Louisiana. And I'll be working with all the Catholic bishops in the next session to get to young people and to other Catholics to be active participants in calling the legislature to say we want to be a life state, not a death state. So things have really changed over those years.
Sister Helen Prejean, born in Baton Rouge, many may not realize that. You've got a rich history in the city where this show originates.
I sure do. I love Baton Rouge. Love to come back to Baton Rouge. Our sisters have a convent there on 100 Oaks. I love to stay with them. My family's there. I love everything about Baton Rouge. I get together with my classmates from the academy. Every time I drive in to see Manuel Ortiz on death row, I'm still accompanying him. He's the third innocent one out of 7 people. He's the 7th one, third innocent one I've been with. And I don't say that lightly. I never dreamed that there could be so many mistakes in the process. And so when I go to see Manuel on death row, I go the night before. I stay with the sisters and usually have a reunion with my classmates, with Renee McGinnis and Marty Dentz and Elise Friu and all my good classmates from 57 at the academy, and eat some good Baton Rouge food, and then head back to New Orleans the next day. So I love Baton Rouge. And I tell a lot of stories of growing up in Baton Rouge and not understanding about racism at all. It was during the Jim Crow days, which I never questioned. And my daddy was a successful lawyer, and we had black servants and who lived in the servants' quarter behind our big house. And I never questioned they couldn't eat with us or use the same toilet or all the Jim Crow stuff. So the waking up part of the book is when I did wake up that the gospel of Jesus was about justice, and I moved into the St. Thomas Housing Project. And then African-American people became my teachers, and I began to learn what white privilege is, what it's like to be black and grow up in an ex-slave state where racism is such a part of everything. I didn't even know about institutional racism, the way it's in language, that white is always lily white and pure black, always bad, blackball, blacklist. And then, of course, I learned very quickly how it's in the criminal justice system, how it's in everything. And so it woke me up.
All right, hold tight, Sister Helen. We want to get to a few people who wish to speak with you for good reason. And Matt says there is one line open, 877-217-5757. David in Atlanta.
Hello?
David, you're on the air.
Thank you. Good morning. Sister Prejean, thank you for your great work. You know, I read where for every conviction unjustly of a white person on a capital crime, seven African Americans are convicted. And I'll give you an example. Ray Liuza was a personal friend who I knew since the 1950s at St. Mary's Italian School in the French Quarter in New Orleans. What do you know about the Thompson case? I've read one time years ago they're going to make a movie about it, and Thompson was evidently unjustified. He was convicted of that murder and weeks away from execution before an assistant attorney in New Orleans confessed on his deathbed that exculpatory evidence.
All right. Well, are you familiar
with that
case?
John Thompson you're talking
yeah.
about?
Yes. David?
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. And you're right about, I mean, so many black people who sit in Orleans Parish Jail because of the whole bond thing. I think that's beginning, at least dialogue's beginning to change on that. And I know that's absolutely true. John Thompson, there was such prosecutorial overreach because, you see, prosecutors have the evidence. They have the DNA evidence. They have everything. And they are supposed, but this has no teeth in it, they are supposed to turn over to defense anything that points toward the innocence of a person. And they don't do it. 90% of the over 150 wrongfully convicted people in this country were sent to death row. It's because of prosecutorial misconduct. And that happened in John Thompson's case. And even when they showed that the ski mask, that the DNA on the ski mask with the blood was not John Thompson's, Harry Connick Sr.'s office still dragged their feet 1 or 2 years before they finally gave John Thompson his freedom. And then when they did a lawsuit to show that the whole prosecutor's office was engaged in this prosecutorial misconduct, even the Supreme Court of the United States said, nah, it was a fluke. There were some underlings that maybe made mistakes, but you couldn't sue the whole prosecutor's office.
Thank you, David, for your call. 877-217-5757 for Sister Helen Prejean, best known as being a death penalty activist. Her book, Dead Man Walking, of course, was 30 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. She's back in a huge way with River of Fire, My Spiritual Journey. And you decided to become a nun right out of St. Joseph's Academy. You were 18.
I did.
Barely 18 years old. Are kids at that age really?
Not now. No. It's not the best thing for most people. You barely mature at 18. You're still making life decisions, and you need to. The people who join our order, far fewer now, but there will always be some, are in their mid-40s. Because you've had time to really discern, you know, about your life. And so that's what's happening now.
Well, you have stayed the course, shall we say. You've been the order for a little longer than I've been alive, and I've been alive for more than 6 decades now. So
what does this mean? Time is such a mystery. All I know is that the energy of God still runs through me, fast and strong. And so I'm going as long as God gives me the life. Now, you know, just one other thing I want to say, Jim, because I know we must be running out of time.
Well, let's see if you'll do it, by the way. We've got some folks who have some questions for you. If you can stay a little longer, I'd appreciate it. So, but keep going.
And I just say that one thing, though, about the book. It is important to get religion right. I have heard Christianity quoted. I have heard people say, well, Jesus was executed for our sins, and that's what saved us. So these people did something, the worst of sins, they're executed for, and that way they go to heaven. Harry Connick Sr. said, death penalty is just a temporary punishment. God punishes people in all eternity in hell, and that's much worse. So we got to get Christianity, we got to get Jesus right, we got to get religion right, because it's quoted to uphold cruelty and punishment and the killing of people in the name of God. We got to get it straight.
Sister Helen Prejean is the voice you are hearing, one of the most eloquent people on the planet. Started in Baton Rouge for her. She still lives in Louisiana in the great city of New Orleans. Spiritual advisor, author, anti-death penalty activist. Her latest work is River of Fire from Random House Hardcover. It is out and about right now. This was the week that it was released, and we'll talk more after this brief time out on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Sister Helen Prejean with us for a few more minutes. Her book is River of Fire, My Spiritual Journey, and she is the most famous death penalty activist. She is, of course, one who has fought for the abolishment of the death penalty and accompanied six people to death row, as in the death chamber where they were taken, their lives were taken by the state. 877-217-5757. Dan downtown. Dan, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana with Sister Helen Prejean.
Yeah, good morning, Sister. Are there prosecutors and judges who care more about carving out a conservative get-off record for personal advancement in red state Louisiana than for the advancement of justice?
Is there political element to this? What do you think, Sister Helen?
I'm sorry, was that a statement, Dan?
Well, I think he's asking if there are conservative justices who believe the death penalty is good for their political viability.
Well, you know, that's making a big statement of judgment to connect politics with justices. But when you look at the track record of justices and you look at their bent in the way that they interpret the Constitution, there are some, and this is along the line of Justice Antonin Scalia, who has died, but a number of the justices that always follow the strict constitutional thing, saying that it was allowed by the framers and we can't change it. But that does not allow for all of the social evolution, psychological evolution that has happened in our understanding of things. For example, the framers of the Constitution said that you couldn't, they defined idiots or mentally challenged people as those that could name their parents or make change. And Justice Scalia went to that to actually resist the Atkins decision that we shouldn't be killing people who are mentally challenged. He was one of the few justices in the country who did that. And that's what happens when you follow that conservative line. And that conservative line is, oh, well, we're just following a strict interpretation of the Constitution. The political ramifications of that, of course, are that people, poor people can continue to be killed. People with mental challenges can be killed. Juveniles can be killed. And where we see what's happening in society is, as we evolve as a people, we see that young people's brains aren't even developed by the time they're 18 years old. And so we change, and they don't want to change. And I think it does fit in with what is called political conservatism.
877-217-5757. And our remaining time with Sister Helen Prejean. Her book is River of Fire. It is Tricia in Ville Platte. Hi, Tricia. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Hi, thank you. I was just calling in for two things. Number one, thank you, Sister Helen. When I was a 1L at LSU, you and Barry Sheck, who runs the Innocence Project, happened to be visiting and convinced me to become a public defender and later represent people.
Oh, wow. Good for you, Tricia. So, good for you.
Well, thank you. The other thing I wanted to say, I spoke to the previous gentleman's caller. I think there was some static and mixed up. My experience, I've worked in several parishes, and my experience in terms of political influence is if a district attorney believes that a particular his constituents will actually convict, I do believe that goes into the decision of whether or not to seek the death penalty to be tough on crime. That's what I've experienced. In Orleans,
yeah,
for instance, it's harder to get that, you know, but in other parishes around the state, I found that district attorneys, if they do feel like they can get a death verdict, are willing to spend the money. Do you agree?
Sister Helen?
Prosecutors live in microcultures, and so they say, oh, well, this is what the people want, so it'll be easier to get a death penalty conviction. There is no doubt about it, though, when they do go for it, it is always going to be a poor person who cannot put up adequate mm-hmm. defense to match them. And so, yes, and we see now the capricious and arbitrary way that death penalty is applied. You can find those prosecutors, that 2% of prosecutors in the United States today are responsible for 50% of deaf people that go to death row, because they have that kind of conglomeration of factors of a microculture, people that want it. It helps their political career, and they go for it. But it's always mm-hmm. going to be poor people, never rich people, who could get an adequate defense and fight the prosecutor every inch of the way. Yes, that is the way it works.
I recall in 1998, 21 years ago, Michelle Milholland, then working for The Advocate, now press secretary for John Neely Kennedy, she wrote that the Baton Rouge prosecutors, led by Doug Morrow, Tony Clayton, people I really like and admire, were good people, but they were throwing death penalty celebration dinners at Chris's
yeah.
Steakhouse when they would get a death penalty conviction.
Yeah.
And even as much as I love Tony Clayton and Doug Morrow, I thought that was that might have been a bit much.
But it shows an attitude underneath it. You know, prosecutors also in Louisiana gave each other these backroom awards called the Louisiana Ha Ha Prick Plaque. And it showed the pelican, state pelican, flying with hypodermic syringes in their talons, which means I got another death penalty. And I actually know this because one of the defense attorneys knew one of the prosecutors and asked to see. And he said, yeah, come see, I got three plaques. See, that's what I mean by microculture. You get political points for getting death penalties. You get reelected to office. But the answer to this is you educate the people, educate the people, educate the people. And that's what we've seen happening in Louisiana and across the nation. We are now really moving in the last days of the death penalty, and I do believe it's going to be ended even on the books in Louisiana as well. And
all right, hold tight, Sister Helen. Steve in Mid-City. Steve, you're on the air with Sister Helen Prejean.
Thank you, Sister Helen, I got to hear you speak at BRCC a few years ago and really enjoyed that and enjoy the discussion. One question I had is, you know, within the Catholic Church, you really see some consistency in, you know, against the death penalty and also a pro-life stance. But outside of the Catholic Church, really on both sides, those seem to fall in different sort of political ideologies. And I was just wondering if you could speak to why you think that is. And that.
All right. What about those who were against abortion but are for the death penalty, and those who are believers in a woman's right to choose to have an abortion but are against the state taking the life of a death row inmate?
I didn't get the name of that last caller.
Steve,
what's your name?
Steve in Mid-City.
Steve. Okay, Steve. First of all, there hasn't been a consistent teaching of the Catholic Church about the death penalty. It took 1,600 years for Pope Francis on August 2nd in 2018 to finally declare in all instances we are opposed to the death penalty. And it took a long time. It took a lot of dialogue with the Catholic Church and with the people, because people made a distinction. And you hear this in the abortion issue still, but it had been Catholic. Oh, well, I'm against abortion, but I'm for the death penalty. And that was the heart of my dialogue with Pope John Paul II, because I said to him, I got a chance to talk to him, and I said, does the Catholic Church only uphold the dignity of innocent life? when I'm walking with a man to execution and he's shackled hand and foot and surrounded by guards, they're leading him down the hall to strap him down and kill him. He's utterly defenseless. Where is the dignity in this death? Can you strengthen the church's position that all life has dignity, innocent as well as guilty? And that's been a big shift of learning within the Catholic Church. And it took 1,600 years for the church to have unequivocal opposition to the death penalty. So I just want to say that first. And what people do in their minds is this: there's a bright line in the sand for them. Innocent life deserves defending. Unborn children, the lives of children, innocent people deserve defending, but not guilty people.
Sister,
and that's what we have to see, that all life has dignity.
Sister Helen, how have you kept your faith amid the revelations of abuse by priests and some nuns, particularly of young people? This has to be something that it shattered the faith of some, but yet you're still there. Why?
Well, my faith is in the gospel of Jesus and in the living of the gospel of Jesus. And I've never based it solely on how people in the institutional church, especially positions of leadership, whether or not they're living the gospel completely or not. Jesus always talked about wheat and weeds coming up together. And that's true in the church too. Faith is based not in who happens to be a bishop or how the priests are doing. It's in the gospel of Jesus. It's in a community of love. The sisterhood has sustained me. The sisterhood has helped me grow in my faith. And so I have grown. And so we, as women in the church, as a sisterhood, have moved into those areas of ministry as Pope Francis is calling us all to be the field hospital out there with the wounded and not stuck in buildings and just emphasizing dogma. We got to get out to where the people are hurting and really make the gospel of Jesus live. It's funny, all about compassion and all about justice. That's where my faith lies.
Finally, Henry at the Country Club wants to know when you're returning to Baton Rouge. Will you be here anytime soon?
I haven't said it yet, and it's usually said around when I come to visit Manuel Ortiz on death row. So we had a visit in August. I'll be coming sometime in September. I can't tell you when, because we're pretty heavy with the book tour in September, but it'll be sometime before the moon rises on the last night of September.
Well, God bless you, Sister Helen Prejean. The book is River of Fire. Always a pleasure and an honor to talk with you.
Thank you, Jim. You too. Keep up your good work.
And we will return with journalist Zahra Hankir from the Middle East about other Middle Eastern women who are risking their lives to report the news.